Welcome to the Oxford Education Deanery podcast. In this series, we explore the latest research from the Department of Education at the University of Oxford and discuss the real-world implications for teachers, parents, and policymakers. Each podcast is accompanied by a Deanery Digest, a short, plain language summary of the research, which can be downloaded from our website.
Welcome to the Oxford Education Deanery podcast. My name is Laura Mulway. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Shin Su, Dr. Laura Seymour, and Dr. Cressida Ryan to the podcast. They are members of the team behind NESL, Neurodivergent Education for Students, Teaching and Learning, a new toolkit designed to support more neurodivergent, inclusive teaching and learning in higher education. Co-created with neurodivergent students and staff, the toolkit brings together practical guidance, reflective activities, case studies and checklists covering teaching practice, assessment, feedback, adjustments and support. In this conversation, we'll hear about the thinking behind the project, how the toolkit was developed, and what institutions and individual educators can do to create more inclusive learning environments. Chin, Laura and Cressida, welcome to the podcast. So my first question goes to Laura, I believe. Laura, could you tell me a little bit about this research? What's it all about? Why is it important?
Yes, so this research project, NESL, was made possible by a Teaching Development and Enhancement Project Award co-funded by the Department of Education and the Social Sciences Division. And the team members were myself, Sheen Cressida, Shangguan Li, Georgia Lin and Hanrei Li. And in brief, our project was about the experiences of teaching and learning at Oxford that neurodivergent people have. And we were interested in the experiences of anyone who was involved in teaching and learning here at Oxford. So from students to hourly paid tutors and lecturers, of which there are many here at Oxford, precariously employed people, heads of department, learning supporters such as librarians, disability advisors, and so on. And while our focus was neurodivergence, we were interested in the person's whole experience. We're well aware that, you know, being neurodivergent at Oxford doesn't exist in a vacuum. So we were also prepared to listen about, for example, how an experience of being neurodivergent might intersect with being an international student and coming to Oxford from abroad, challenges around second language learning, experiences such as racism, including institutional racism, gender. So perhaps we'll get onto this, but several of the participants in our research project talked about how the expectations around what neurodivergence looks like is often very much geared towards boys. And so how, you know, being a woman, for example, who was neurodivergent, it was a kind of very particular kind of experience that often wasn't picked up and wasn't kind of properly seen. And why this research is important, for me, one of the things that was most important about this research is that we centered neurodivergent people's knowledges and experiences right from the start of the project. Whenever knowledge about neurodivergence is being produced, whenever neurodivergence is being discussed, it's really crucial for neurodivergent people to be genuinely involved in that. So not just tokenistically, but genuinely as experts, which we are. And for me, that was so important right from the start to the finish to be drawing on our neurodivergent colleagues and students' expertise, knowledge, experience, which they so generously shared with us. And also, our project is important because our goal was important, which is to improve the teaching and learning experience of neurodivergent people here at Oxford.
Absolutely. I think that's such an important goal, such a large, complex project that you have embarked on here as well. Just listening to you speak then about all of the people that perhaps were contributing to the project and their many rich and diverse experiences, I can imagine that you have a lot of data. So, which brings me to my second question, which is, could you explain to me a little, Cressida, what exactly you did and how you gathered all of these experiences together?
Yes, sure. Thank you. the university always talks about the relationship between teaching and research, and it's not always that relationship's not always very clear. And I think for us, it was really important that we took the research and we were able to turn it into something that was pragmatic, very usable, instantly applicable, and then enhanced teaching, and that teaching fed research and research fed teaching. So we were coming at it with that kind of idea. And what we then did is several phases. We recruited at various different levels. So we had us as a team. We also then had a team of advisors, because we wanted to make sure that we had an advisory board who could check what we were doing, keep us on track, give expert opinion. And they came from both in Oxford and beyond, including internationally, so that we could draw in expertise. So we were casting the net wide in terms of getting information. And that was our first step, actually. And then our next step was to run focus groups. So we ran focus groups once we'd recruited students, with both students and staff, because we wanted to hear the experiences from all the way around. So we split students into undergraduates and graduates, and then we had staff, because we wanted to make sure everyone was in their own cohort and felt safe in their own cohort. And we had a graduate student leading the student focus groups, again, to try and make it feel like more of a peer discussion rather than some kind of interrogation. And we always wanted to model good neurodivergent practice while we were doing that. So it was always a question of what can we do to show that we're really committed to this. This isn't theory, this is practice. So we did things like hire a therapist so that anybody who needed it could have a debrief session afterwards, because we knew we were asking people to make themselves vulnerable and that wasn't something we were in a position to carry. So what could we do to enable them to feel safe enough to engage well with us? And that worked. It was used and it worked. I think it was something that was very well appreciated. We also made sure we paid everyone, even in vouchers, because so much disability work relies on goodwill and volunteering, and that's not sustainable or appropriate. People need to be recognised for their experience and their engagement. So we had all these principles underlying our work that then came out as we went. And people would be saying, oh, no, don't worry about it. But we were saying, no, this is important. This is what we believe in and how we're running it. So we collected a lot of data those ways. And then we moved into individual interviews with anyone who was interested. And we interviewed a number of our advisory panel and further staff so that we could collect an awful lot of information about what it felt like. We then sifted it all, coded it all, and built it all into the toolkit as it exists as a document. I'm very much a pragmatist, so the idea of a toolkit as a document frustrated me from the start, but it's a good starting point. And what we're able to do, neurodivergent strength, pattern spotting, looking at the bigger picture, we were able to go through all that data and say, okay, well, there are big themes emerging here. There are themes about individual, collective, institutional, wider group elements. And so we built a metaphorical framework for that. And then, because again, we wanted to own everything and recognize everything, we had an intern, Henry, and she designed us images so that we could express our work in images that were designed from within the project. So it really was about the co-creation and the creativity inherent in neurodivergence. But then we also looked at the practical elements, the assessment elements, all the different elements of teaching and learning. So we had lots of different wings, and then we tried to bring them together under major themes with quotations, with short checklists so everyone could say these are things you can do, with bibliographies, with all of that. So we have this long document that's a repository of all of this. But then, because we wanted to make sure it was usable, we turned it into a canvas, an open access canvas site, where every single chunk also has a video explaining how to use it, so that if you're more of a visual and auditory person, you can do it instead of reading it. So again, principles in action. But we were also able to put the case studies up, do some interactive activities so people could try out the things we were saying, write branching scenarios. So we're not saying to people, this is what you should do. We're saying, think about what might happen if you do it this way, because we're not judging you. Everyone's going to be doing things their own way. That's fine. But your own way can be nuanced by what you think the implications might be. And you can have made some of that scaffolding and rehearsal explicit. So we did all of that and built up both the dynamic side and the static side. And then because we had such a large base of people involved, we were able to bring them all in to give us feedback, because it was, well, you've contributed to this. We're not putting this out without you being happy. So closing that circle of bringing everyone back in and being able to collectively agree that this is what we thought worked. So it was a multi-phase project in that sense, but it brought in a lot of both research stuff and much more pragmatic, practical stuff.
It's fascinating. Thank you. And I think relatively unusual still, although it shouldn't be, to have such a broad consensus arrived at within the research project, and to actually close that circle and bring people back in is wonderful. It really gives, I think, the output from this project some weight, I suppose face validity with the community that you are hoping to serve. Could I ask you, Shin, to speak now a little bit and just walk us through some of perhaps the main findings from all of this work?
Yes, of course. Thank you. So in terms of what we found, there are, as Cressida already said, a lot of, we hope, helpful and practical suggestions and advices for people. But firstly, we've got this framework to understand neurodivergent inclusive teaching and learning, which includes four key areas. So the first one includes awareness and understanding, meaning people should have the space and capacity to understand more about neurodivergence. We understand that people can be at different phases in their journey learning about neurodivergence. That's all fine. But when an educator is open about their learning journey about neurodivergence, that can still make a difference to the students. And then the second one is about teaching practice, space, and materials. So that actually includes a lot of issues and to think about, including, for instance, the physical spaces of where teaching happens. If the teaching happens in lecture halls, how can you make sure the sensory requirements and needs are met from all the students and other people? And it also includes the social, psychological spaces where people should be able to feel safe and comfortable sharing their neurodivergence, if they want, with their educators. It also includes materials. For instance, every one of the participants highlighted the importance of sharing materials well in advance to students. That seems like a very small act, but will make people's life much easier, especially for those who need the time to process things in advance. We also talked about very practical suggestions. For instance, allow students or encourage them to use fidgets in classrooms, or feel free to move around and not just sitting still all the time. And also thinking about having quiet rooms that are available for people who need to have some time and space to decompose and to have a quiet time for themselves. Then the third aspect is assessment and feedback. So this is very important for students, but what we also argue for is there need to be a rethinking about what academic success means and looks like, and what academic success looks like for everyone, including neurodivergent students. It might not be the normally universally accepted ways of, you know, scoring very high in written exams. So we argue there should be more diverse ways of thinking about assessment methods and offering the options for different students so that they're not assessed by one size or one uniformed assessment. And then the final one is talking about adjustment and support. We argue it's important to have new universally accessible support for everyone. So if you design learning that are universally accessible, it helps neurodivergent students. It also helps all of the students and actually also educators. In our research, there were also neurodivergent educators who participated and shared their experiences. There were actual labor and emotional labor that are involved for them to support students. If the teaching and learning are designed universally accessible, it actually eases everyone's labor. So finally, as Cressida also said, we've put this into four dimensions. So we argue changes should happen not only with individuals. It should happen with individuals, with communities, with institutions, and also within the sectors. So sector-wide transformations about understandings about neurodivergent, and then more regulations, policies, more wider discussions about neurodivergence and demystifying neurodivergence are very, very important. There are more practical examples and tips that we can share. But if you're interested, the resources is available online, open access on our website, as well as on the Deanery Resources page.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Wow, there's a lot to discuss, isn't there? And I think you've brought us nicely, Shin, to the final question, which is really, what does this all mean in any case. So if I, for example, were a listener here thinking, what can I do as a result of this work? What should I be thinking about? Perhaps could you speak a little bit to that, to the wider impact that you hope to see from this research?
Yes, Cressida here. I think about this a lot because my current role is a disability advisor and I share an office with our SPLD tutors. And so we're constantly having those discussions about, well, what does this actually mean? And they hand out the postcard resources we've had available, etc. And as you said, this is a lot of material and a lot of people involved, and it's been a very complex project. And that kind of complexity does come across as quite intimidating and inaccessible in its own right. So one of the big questions has been, how do we ensure this is accessible and usable, and what difference is it going to make? And we're really keen to take the late Michael Mosley's approach, just one thing. What is the just one thing a tutor could do? And can we model just one thing? What would it mean to give a case study of, say, well, how about you just try this one small thing? And for me, it's been about trying to parcel up the toolkit in those little bite-sized bits, which the checklists do, for example, and say, well, why don't you just try this, reflect on it, and then see what happens, and try the next thing. And that message is slowly getting communicated, and we're using university channels to do that. But we've also been able to publicise it much more widely. So because we had such a broad base advising us as well, this has been picked up by institutions across the country, and we're getting people saying, okay, can we use it for training purposes, etc. So we're also now doing things like putting together slide packs so that people can use them as the scaffold for some training, or offering training ourselves and going into induction weeks or staff trainings and saying, okay, let us show you how you could do these just one thing moments, or understand a little better your own neurodivergence as well as your students. I went to a group of IT managers at one point, and one of the discussions we had to have was acknowledging in the room that the majority of people in that room probably had some neurodivergence going on. And that was our starting point, was that openness. So it's opening those conversations. And for us, what this means and where this is going is, I think of it as a relay race in some terms. We've created a baton, and now we need to pass it on to other people. And where's it going next? So that might mean academic articles, it might mean blog posts. There are various things that just mean, okay, we have done this. This was relatively new and unusual. What can anyone else do with it now? We're here to help seed that journey.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. Is there anything that you would like to add to that, either Laura or Shin?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that Cressida has said. And I just want to emphasise what this research doesn't mean, and what it doesn't mean is that the job is done. I think the danger when any kind of EDI report comes out in an institution or a business is that the very fact that there is a report or a project has been done is taken to mean that, oh, look, we're not ableist anymore. But actually reading our toolkit, every page pretty much is full of neurodivergent people saying, no, this improvement needs to be made, or, you know, this thing is not working for us. So what it doesn't mean is that the job is done. And we really tried not to be prescriptive in the advice that we gave. In many different arenas, I've had conversations with colleagues, or kind of been in conversations with colleagues, where almost prescriptive advice was sought. Like, you know, what do I do in this situation? What do I say in this situation to not be ableist? And actually, our advice that we tried to convey throughout the toolkit is just be the most empathetic version of you, you know, as a human being who cares about teaching and learning, as someone who is reflective. Just think, what would you like to do in this situation? What do you think would be good to do based on your knowledge and experience? We've provided some advice, like Cressida said, of things you can try. But really, we wanted the toolkit to be empowering for people to say, oh, maybe I'll take this and make it my own.
Thank you so much. And Shin, I can see you'd like to come in on that.
Yes, thank you, Cressida and Laura. And just to follow up on that, we also hope that the toolkit is not only for educators or leaders or decision makers, it should also be for the neurodivergent students. We hope that the toolkit will be something that can help them at least understand some of the good practices that could happen, and also to have the toolkit, to share the toolkit with anyone that involved in teaching, that they will think that will help them to better understand neurodivergent inclusive teaching and learning. And perhaps this could also be a signal for them that they're not alone in this. So we hope this is like a seed that we've planted and so that it can grow and in a collective way as how it was created.
That's a really interesting idea that actually as a student, this could be an empowering piece of work that could help them to advocate for themselves. But of course, I imagine for meaningful change to happen, you do also need institutional buy-in.
Exactly.
It's interesting that it could be both bottom-up and top-down.
Yes, I also think, coming back to the first point I made about the university's focus on the relationship between teaching and research, that this has started a bit of a spiral for me in terms of that relationship, because it's inspired a load more research. So I found myself recently being asked to give a conference paper on comprehensible input, a language teaching strategy, as a form of universal design for learning to support neurodivergent students to meet the Equality Act by preparation, etc. So it's been really wonderful to see that loop start to change and the impact on us as educators. We didn't come to this as specialists wanting to dictate things. We came at it as people with some kind of academic interest, lived experience, interest and curiosity, but prepared to learn ourselves. And I have a linguistics background, and I've ended up finding myself writing articles based on the work I've done, particularly with neurodivergent clergy, because clergy are disproportionately neurodivergent, and I have taught a lot of trainee clergy. They've been a great group to work with to say, okay, what am I learning from you? And thinking about what does it mean to be kind? Laura talked about being the most empathetic version of yourself possible. And I think one of the things that people often struggle with is what does that mean in practice, and the be kind sense of being quite open-ended and gentle and I would hate to use the word, but fluffy. And actually that goes down really badly with most neurodivergent people. So what does it mean to be kind may in fact be the biggest message I've taken away, because it's made me go and think about both what compassion and empathy look like, but also what that looks like in linguistic terms to ensure I'm communicating exactly what I do mean and hearing my students exactly back. So I've ended up looking at things like uses of passive verbs and implied agents, and where a student who's quite traumatized through their neurodivergence hears themselves put upon because they're assuming they're an implied agent when they're not, etc. And it's been really interesting to drill down into what it means to enable someone to feel comfortable. So I think for me, the project's been really important in causing a spiral of research and teaching, informing each other and continuing on an important conversation.
Thank you, Krista. It's really fascinating as a linguist to hear your personal reflections on the impact that this has already had on you and the way that you think about teaching and research.
I would just like to add librarians. So one of the conversations, so we've been writing an article based on this project as well, an academic article. And one of the things that has come out of the process of writing that article is the need for more research on learning developers, you know, librarians, disability support people, because several of the students that we interviewed mentioned how important librarians were in their experience of education, and how a good librarian was just an absolute gold dust person. You know, they did things like provided earplugs in the library that anyone could take, for example, and there's something about librarians, I think, that needs to that merits further study. Librarians are quietly doing amazing accessibility work, I think. And one of the things that I sort of regret about, I mean, it was an amazing project to be part of, but one of the things that I wish we had done is included more interviews with people who were involved in supporting and developing learning, like librarians, like disability support advisors.
Right, yes. And that's a further research project. Clearly the work is not complete as it stands.
Can I also jump in to say that this also builds on the collective work that's been going on, led by Laura and Shine at Oxford, the Neurodiversity at Oxford initiative. Laura, would you like to talk a bit more about that, maybe?
I can do if you want. Yeah, so from 2021 to 2023, Sean Gronley, who was also a member of our project team, we set up and ran a project called Neurodiversity at Oxford, which was a more community-based project to support, connect and empower neurodivergent staff and students at Oxford. So we did things like film nights, training sessions, and it was really about fostering that neurodivergent community. And that experience really helped me in terms of designing this accessible research project. And it's also something I've carried forward. So I currently run a project at Swansea University about neurodivergence, and it's extremely collaborative as well. So I really cannot emphasize enough the amazing wisdom that neurodivergent people have. And as a researcher, it's less about sort of being the expert, like Cressida said. It's really about listening, and you can't listen enough to neurodivergent people.
Wonderful to hear that the work has a continuing legacy in this way. Is there, would you like, if there are any listeners who are Swansea related, is there a way that they can get in contact with you?
Yes, they can email me on laura.seymour@swansea.ac.uk. They can also check out our website, which is earlymodernneurodivergence.com. Or they can, yes, we brought that domain. Or they can follow us on Instagram and Blue Sky. So it's amend.project. And yeah, really, it's exponentially more and more collaborative. So please do get in touch if there's lots of ways to get involved and share your knowledge and hopefully have fun as well.
Well, that brings us to the end of our conversation together here. But clearly that is not the end for this team or the work that is ongoing. A few different resources have been mentioned throughout our discussion today. All of the links to the resources and contact information, should you wish to learn more about the work that has been discussed today, will be available on the Deanery pages and in the show notes for this particular podcast episode. So please do take a look at that if this has whet your appetite. All that remains is for me to thank my three guests for your contributions today. And to say it has been an absolute pleasure hearing a little bit more about this project. And now on my to-do list is to go and have a better look at the checklists. Huge thanks.
And, excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
You've been listening to the Oxford Education Deanery podcast. To find out more about the research featured in today's episode and everything else the Deanery has to offer, visit our website and sign up to our newsletter. You'll find the links in the show notes.